From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Konghatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The heads of several U.S. intelligence agencies gave testimonies to the Senate Intelligence Committee on Tuesday, directly contradicting the foreign policy positions of President Donald Trump and his administration. The officials included FBI Director Christopher Wray, CIA Director Gina Haspel, and Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats. All three contradicted the positions that Trump has taken on Iran, North Korea, Russia, Syria, and more. Most strikingly, they made no mention of the U.S.-Mexico border, which Trump has constantly touted as the greatest national security threat facing the U.S. President Trump angrily ranted on Twitter against the intelligence heads for contradicting him, saying, quote, "Perhaps intelligence should go back to school." My guest is Kevin Martin. He is the president of Peace Action and convener of the Korea Peace Network. Welcome to the program, Kevin.
Glad to be with you.
So there were many issues that were discussed at the Senate Intelligence Committee hearing on Tuesday, and it should be mentioned that that's the reason why the Intelligence Committee requests briefings from intelligence heads, right? This is part of our checks and balances. They want to know from these nonpartisan agencies what the real threats are facing U.S. national security, and that the president is leading the country in line with these intelligence heads and their assessments. Were you shocked at how much they contradicted Trump?
Not necessarily, because the intelligence chiefs, along with a lot of the foreign policy elite in Washington, are generally status quo about most things. Now, we're going to have to go through it issue by issue, and I think we can't cover it all in a brief interview here today. But it wasn't that big of a surprise. What is interesting to me is the media reaction. I read a headline that said intelligence chiefs prove that Trump's foreign policy isn't based in reality. So with everything these days, Trump eats the story, and it's all about, well, what did they say and how does that jibe or not with Trump's view of the world, and what does it mean for Trump's policies on this or that issue? But I can't say I was all that surprised.
And of course, then followed his very overt insulting of his own intelligence heads. Let's talk about issue by issue, starting with North Korea, which is a topic that's deeply familiar to you. On the issue of North Korea, these intelligence heads were basically convinced that North Korea was not going to denuclearize, no matter what it was that the President Kim Jong-un said to the United States as part of the warming of relations between the U.S. and North Korea. And one could see the positioning of the U.S. on North Korea as perhaps Trump's most positive foreign policy achievement, if you will. So what did you make of their assertion that, no, North Korea will be remaining or is refusing to give up its nuclear weapons?
For the time being, yes, because the United States hasn't given any reason in terms of security assurances as to why North Korea should get rid of its nuclear weapons. I think it's very interesting that they've announced that there probably is going to be a summit, or I guess they have said there will be a summit in late February, but they still haven't picked the dates or fixed the venue, although it's widely thought that it will be in Vietnam. I actually think that's kind of a good sign, because I think they won't have another summit unless they have something more concrete to show for it. And I think, at bare minimum, an easing of sanctions and increased humanitarian access for North Korea, in addition to some other concessions that the United States could make, which wouldn't get rid of North Korea's nukes right away. That's going to take quite a long time. But that would make North Korea be willing to trade something. So whether it's a full listing of all their facilities, a verifiable freeze on their missile testing, on their nuclear development, their nuclear material. But yeah, of course, North Korea is not getting rid of their nukes anytime soon. Are we getting rid of our nukes anytime soon? Is North Korea crazy to want nukes to protect itself against the United States? No, they're not. It's very logical. Not that I want North Korea or anyone to have nuclear weapons. So I didn't think the intelligence assessment really added a lot on that issue.
Right. Trump tweeted, "North Korea relationship is best it has ever been with the U.S. No testing, getting remains, hostages returned, and then he added, decent chance of denuclearization. It's almost as if he's walking back the very wild claims that he had been making, which might have been jumping the gun a little bit, right? In claiming earlier that this was a done deal, that North Korea had agreed to denuclearization, whereas North Koreans were like, wait a minute, hang on.
No, and then you even saw last week there was a mainstream media report about this supposedly new missile base that was found, and that this was somehow, you know, evidence of North Korea's cheating or their perfidy or whatever. Well, it turns out we've actually known about that missile base for a long time, and there's no agreement that they're supposed to be dismantling their missile bases. Is there an agreement that the United States is going to dismantle its missile bases in the region? Not at all. What I think is interesting about this Korea situation right now, and remember the astonishing progress we've made just since the Olympics last year were in South Korea, and you go back even before that, and Trump was threatening fire and fury like the world has never seen, and, you know, lobbing, you know, nuclear threats back at each other. The track of North Korea and South Korea reconciliation, which has really been led by President Moon of South Korea, and he's by far the most important president in this whole equation, not President Trump, that has been astonishing. The moves towards reconciliation between North and South Korea. If that gets too far out of track with what the United States wants in terms of denuclearization, people of Korea may not care. You could see, and I'm not advocating this, but you could see in 5 to 10 years, not only more reconciliation, maybe even reunification of the Korean Peninsula and one Korea, no longer North and South, and it still be a nuclear power with, you know, South Korea and North Korea sharing the responsibility for that. I'm not predicting that. I'm not saying that would be great, but I'm saying there is the danger of a disjointed two tracks between the North and South Korea reconciliation and then the denuclearization track. I think everybody would prefer that they were more in alignment. And we'll see between now and this summit that's supposed to be at the end of February.
Let's talk about Iran. Perhaps the most positive foreign policy achievement of the Obama administration was the Iran nuclear deal, a deal struck alongside Europe with the Iranian regime. And the intelligence communities seem to be agreeing that nuclear deal had been working, and then President Trump dismantled it. On this issue, it seems as though the intelligence heads had it right.
It was interesting because there is continuity there. And going back to what I originally said, that you often do see continuity or status quo in the intelligence community. If you go back to before the agreement that Obama, and not just Obama, of course, but the P5+1 negotiated with Iran, there was consistently for years consensus intelligence assessments that Iran didn't have nuclear weapons, was not acquiring them, didn't even want to have them. The newest assessment that came out on Tuesday, they did seem to walk back a few things, and it looked to me that they maybe are trying to cook the books in Trump and Pompeo and especially Bolton's favor. Bolton, of course, has wanted a war with Iran for decades. But overall, yes, the assessment is Iran is still complying with the agreement.
Trump is not happy about this assessment. He tweeted that the intelligence people seem to be extremely passive and naive when it comes to the dangers of Iran. They are wrong. When I became president, Iran was making trouble all over the Middle East and beyond. Since ending the terrible Iran nuclear deal, they are much different, but a source of potential danger and conflict. He said they are testing rockets and more and coming very close to the edge. Their economy is now crashing, which is the only thing holding them back. Be careful of Iran. Perhaps intelligence should go back to school. It's amazing to see these contrasting positions on North Korea versus Iran, where the issue in both cases is nuclear weapons, although, of course, there's huge differences. If Trump truly wanted denuclearization, he would have preserved the Iran nuclear deal while pursuing this deal with North Korea, right?
Exactly. Now, a lot of what Trump is getting at has to do with this nonsensical supposed regional alliance between Saudi Arabia, Israel, and the United States as the bulwark of civilization against the savage, you know, Shiite Iran, which is just ridiculous. And a lot of it also just seems to be Trump's, well, if Obama did it, it was wrong. If Obama said the sky is blue, that was wrong. It's childish. It's ridiculous. And I think a very interesting thing that's going to come up few weeks from now, this supposed Middle Eastern security conference in Poland. And it was framed at first as this anti-Iran meeting. And the Polish government was very embarrassed about that. They're having it because they want a U.S. military base in Poland. That's why they're having this. It was just announced today that Vice President Pence and Secretary of State Pompeo are going to that. And they've already had to walk it back and are talking about it now as a more broad conference about security in the region. And it's not just bashing on Iran. So it's good that they've already had to walk that back, because they clearly do not have the support of our European allies, including the ones that signed the agreement, the P5 plus one, and others, for some sort of broad front against Iran, whether you're talking about in the region or in Europe or wherever. So that'll be interesting to see how that plays out between now and mid-February.
Now, there's the issue then of the Islamic State, which is critical to especially the U.S. presence in Syria. Trump has maintained that the Islamic State is defeated. We're going to pull out of Syria. There was some concern about leaving Syrian Kurds at the mercy of Turkey and the Syrian government. And the entire assumption about the U.S. pulling out of Syria was based on the fact that the Islamic State has been defeated. The intelligence community says, yes, it has been defeated, but that there are still these fighters all over the area, thousands of fighters in Iraq and Syria. There's still some infrastructure that this Islamic State maintains, and they seemed to assert that it was too soon to pull out of Syria. Now, Republican congressmen and women have also taken issue and differed with Trump on this pullout from Syria. Mitch McConnell introduced a resolution saying that it would be disastrous to just pull out of Syria. What do you make of Trump and the intelligence community? I mean, from an anti-war perspective, Trump's positioning can be a good thing.
The United States has no business being in Syria, and it's only a few thousand troops. And the question has to be, well, what are a few thousand troops going to be able to accomplish? And if you're going to What's the alternative? I would think McConnell and others would say, if they're serious about this, that we need 10 or 15,000 troops, and then people would really be against that. We have helped make a horrible mess in Syria. If there's any responsibility in terms of the United States at all, it's for more refugee aid, for more humanitarian aid, for more development aid, but our troops need to get out of there. Trump has this one right. Now, there have been a lot of questions about him announcing it by tweet. He's not really doing it the right way, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, the best way to get the troops out is put them on a plane and send them home. And I think that'll get hashed out. But it, again, you do see a lot of sort of status quo. Let's leave our military footprint the way it is in a lot of parts of the world.
And isn't it critical, if you really care about the plight of the Syrian people, which all of us should care about it, the plight of Syrian Kurds, to work toward a diplomatic resolution that involves Russia and Iran, both of whom are deeply involved in Syria, and actually work to protect Syrian people from Bashar al-Assad's dictatorial regime and from the Islamic State.
And lifting the Muslim ban so that more refugees can come here if they want to. Although, of course, a lot of refugees plan to stay closer to home in the region because it's easier to go home. And so what you're talking about would require adult, patient, multilateral diplomacy. And we'll see if Trump has the patience for that. But his impulse to get the troops out of there is correct. And they should get out of there as soon as they can. And again, if we can help, and people agree that we can help, with refugee resettlement, humanitarian aid, development aid for the people of Syria to help, you know, put back together that broken country, fine. But it's not a military solution, never has been. And a few thousand troops, what is that supposed to do? And it's somewhat similar to Afghanistan as well. Mm-hmm. If we have 15,000 troops and some people want to keep the troops there, why do they think that 15,000 troops can accomplish what we didn't accomplish when we had 100,000 troops?
Right. And on both Syria and Afghanistan, you had you have this potential drawdown of troops. The U.S. envoy to Afghanistan, Zalmay Khalilzad, has announced a peace framework agreement with the Taliban as a precursor to removing troops from there. Now, interestingly, Kevin, you have Mitch McConnell, the Senate majority leader, as I mentioned, introducing this resolution in the Senate earlier this week, saying that it would recognize the dangers of precipitous withdrawal from either conflict and highlight the need for diplomatic engagement and political solutions to the underlying conflicts in Syria and Afghanistan. The second part of that statement sounds fine, right? Diplomatic engagement, political solutions. But it seems as though on foreign policy issues like wars, the Democrats and Republicans, for the most part, have been quite happy to promote war. And there's been a sort of bipartisan consensus on keeping wars going. And now you have the Republicans breaking with Trump. And of course, there is some movement on the left in the Democratic Party, too.
Sure. Well, and on that, what's important, and this cuts across a lot of issues, is Congress to reassert its authority over issues of war and peace, because that's been eroding for a long time. It's been worse since 9/11, but Congress has mostly been supine on its constitutional authority over war and peace, an issue we have talked about a bit that we hope to see more emphasis on and more action, actually, is in Yemen in terms of the United States' role in supporting Saudi Arabia. Trump is all in on that. Congress is mostly against him. We won a vote in the Senate, but just narrowly lost in the House. Those bills are being reintroduced again. And in terms of Afghanistan, there's never been a military solution. And I do think you have to look at it through two lenses. One is U.S. security. And I think McConnell and others would say they're afraid of another 9/11 style attack being launched from Afghanistan. But there's actually not really much reason to think that that would happen again if the Taliban were in control of the country. Now, I'm not saying it's a great thing for the people of Afghanistan for them to be in control of the country. That's not for me to say. And I think reconciliation, looking at regional differences, tribal differences, ethnic differences, et cetera, and that, you know, stitching that government back together in Afghanistan, that's up to the people there. Again, if we can help with that, humanitarian aid, development aid, et cetera, fine. But there's no place for the U.S. military in Afghanistan, and there never has been a military solution. And are we going to stay there another 18 years until we figure that out? It's been 18 years, and what do we have to show for it?
The longest official war in U.S. history. So you have, you mentioned Yemen and Saudi Arabia. There has been a resolution introduced in the House, reintroduced, I should say, just on Wednesday by progressives and in the Senate as well. Bernie Sanders is a part of that. You have Representative Ro Khanna in the House, and they're reintroducing, basically trying to reassert the war powers authority that belongs in Congress. I'm not sure if the intelligence community heads that testified to the Senate Intelligence Committee on Tuesday mentioned anything about Yemen and Saudi Arabia. That's, especially Saudi Arabia, has often been a topic that the intelligence community has had a massive blind spot on, right? Because Saudi Arabia buys a bunch of weapons from the U.S.
Exactly. I haven't read the full report. I've read some excerpts and some reports about it. I would imagine that in talking about the overall sort of regional dynamics, they probably do address that. But I didn't see anything that specifically addressed Yemen. And there's a good reason, because there's no U.S. military interest or national security interest in our continuing to support Saudi Arabia and its coalition in this horrible slaughter in Yemen, which is, by a lot of estimates, the worst humanitarian catastrophe in the world. And we did succeed in winning in the Senate last year. We narrowly lost in the House. Those are both gearing up again. And it is significant, without getting too legal congressional scholarly on you here, this is the first time since 1973 that war powers resolution was passed to reassert congressional authority over matters of war and peace. And we don't know for sure if it will set a precedent that could be used in other circumstances. I certainly hope so, because we really have a monarchy in terms of war and peace issues in this country, that the president can pretty much decide on their own, you know, what to do in terms of intervening and sending troops here or there. And, you know, we send troops all over the place when there's no, not only declaration of war, but not even an AUMF, authorization for the use of military force, or they misuse the AUMFs that were passed back in 2001 and 2002. And even Obama himself admitted that. And I don't want to get into all that legalese right now. The point being, Congress, representing the people, is entrusted, according to the Constitution, with the power to declare war. Congress has given up so much of that to the executive, with disastrous consequences for our democracy and for the people that we've killed in all these interventions. So it's very good. In addition to, of course, the main thing is to alleviate the horrible suffering of the people of Yemen.
Now, Kevin, the intelligence community made zero mention of the U.S.-Mexico border. And if you listen to Just Trump, which, of course, his base does religiously, that should have been and is the only important national security focus worth paying attention to. Trump has repeatedly mentioned that there's violence and crime pouring over the border, drugs pouring over the border. We're going to reduce drug deaths once we build a big, beautiful wall. And his own intelligence community heads didn't seem to think that that was an issue worth mentioning in the intelligence community hearing. That omission is really significant, isn't it?
I would say their silence spoke volumes on that issue.
So let's go further south of the border. Although it didn't come up in the intelligence community hearing, your colleague John Rainwater wrote a really important piece on the unfolding situation in Venezuela. And I'd love to segue into that next as we wrap up our conversation. There is what many people consider a slow-moving U.S.-backed coup taking place in Venezuela with a opposition leader named Juan Guaido, who declared himself interim president, that the U.S., Canada, and a number of U.S. allies in Latin America have decided to recognize as a legitimate president, even though Nicolas Maduro remains in power. There have been sanctions on the state-owned oil company of Venezuela, and now Venezuelan authorities have prevented Juan Guaido from leaving the country and are going to look into a criminal prosecution of his role. And unfortunately, this issue tends to devolve into sort of a black and white Venezuelan, government of Maduro good and protesters who want him out are bad. But it's more complicated than that, isn't it?
Very much so. And we're really covering the map here, the world map. I think I need my world map on the wall here to keep track of where we're talking about. My understanding is that President Maduro, whether you like him or not, was legitimately elected. And the reports I've read said that it was a free and fair election. So the fact that he has even said he's willing to negotiate with the opposition is a huge concession. It's totally illegitimate for Trump or some of the European nations or anybody else to recognize an alternative president. I would argue Maduro is a more legitimate president than Trump. Trump lost the election. Hillary Clinton won the popular election. Would other countries, would Mexico or whoever say, you know what, we're going to recognize Hillary? Now, personally, I wouldn't have a problem with that. But in terms of other countries, you know, meddling around with the legitimacy of who is the United States president, certainly Trump wouldn't like that and his supporters wouldn't like it. The U.S. has no business supporting any opposition leader and declaring them to be the legitimate president. It was farcical that they even did that. But, you know, there are some old ideas, bad ideas that just die very hard in Washington, especially when you have people like Elliot Abrams being appointed now by the administration to run policy on Venezuela. He should be in jail. He was convicted in the Iran-Contra scandal. He was pardoned. That's the only reason he's not in jail. So, you know, there have been people that, whether it's an oil grab, they want to get a hold of Venezuela's oil. They were talking yesterday about, the U.S. trying to do more business with the oil company in Venezuela. I mean, it's just, again, old bad ideas never seem to die. United States and other countries have no business recognizing anybody other than Maduro as the legitimate president. And I've even seen speculation that Cuba could be next in terms of, a lily pad or a launching pad if the United States somehow gets involved in mucking things up in Venezuela, which would be a disaster. And I don't think we should make light of the possibility. If this descends into a civil war, there are already 100,000 refugees who've left Venezuela, mostly because of hard economic conditions. You might have a Syria, in our hemisphere. It would be horrible for the people of Venezuela and for the region.
Meanwhile, you have John Bolton holding onto a notepad, waving it to the public. I mean, it did not seem like an accident that he had the words 5,000 troops in Colombia written on his notepad that was available for the whole world to see. It seemed like a veiled threat. Now, John Rainwater wrote, polls show that a large majority of Venezuelans, including many of those who oppose Maduro, oppose foreign military intervention to remove Maduro. We see this happening often, right, where protests, legitimate protests, are weaponized by countries like the U.S. us to make the case for regime change. What is the diplomatic path out of this crisis? Because Venezuelans are hurting if there is an exodus out of the country. And I mean, it's so much more complex than that, that we wouldn't be able to cover it all in one small conversation. There are race and class issues at play here as well. But if the U.S. were to play a positive, constructive role, what could it be in Venezuela?
You know, the problem is we have the reverse Midas touch. Everything we touch, you know, turns to mud rather than gold. And our record is so poor, particularly of military interventions or regime change. That would be a disaster. Venezuela still has 500,000 troops, most of whom I think are still, aligned with the government. So I think any kind of military intervention absolutely has to be taken off the table. And I don't know that Maduro would be threatened by U.S. troops being sent to the region, but that's a horrible idea as well. Again, I think Maduro has already given a large concession by saying that he is willing to negotiate. I don't think the United States has any role in being a mediator. We already picked sides, right? The Vatican, I think Mexico and Uruguay in the last few days have called for regional mediation and that they could be part of. And I think, you know, that's the way to go. If you have legitimate outside actors who do not seem to have imperial designs on Venezuela's oil, there's no role for the United States that I can see. I think mediation through other means, other actors that do have some good faith and could command respect both by the government and by the opposition. But until any of that happens, Maduro is the legitimate president, legitimately elected in an election that was certified by outside observers as free and fair. So it's a big concession for him to say that he is willing to. And I'm not pro-Maduro, pro Chavez, whatever. I do think they focused on the needs of the people versus the elites and the corporations, et cetera, that, you know, had run things for a long time in Venezuela, similar to Lula in Brazil. So there certainly is that reservoir of goodwill. On the other hand, a lot of people are hurting and the economy is in terrible shape. Again, 100,000 refugees have already left Venezuela. So it's clearly not a stable situation. And I do think that outside mediation, not by the United States, could be helpful in trying to bring about a resolution.
Kevin, give out a website for Peace Action.
Peaceaction.org.
And we'll link to that as well as John's article about Venezuela from our website. Thank you so much, Kevin, as always.
Glad to be here.
Kevin Martin is the president of Peace Action. He's also the convener of the Korea Peace Network. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.